We are still in Parakeet Aleph, chapter 31, chapter 11, I should say, and dealing with Yiftach, and things get worse and stranger. I think I called it in the email, uglier and uglier. This is just rough stuff, what he does. Makes for a great story, though. So, remember that in the beginning of the story, he was an outcast. Right, outcast by his family, ends up running a band of Reikim of some kind, empty people of some kind, out off to the east. The people are suffering under the hand of Amon. They come back to Yiftach and say, you know, will you help us against Amon? And Yiftach's response is to demand that he be made into a leader, which they accept. They even make him the leader before the war. He has this diplomatic outreach to Amon that is a total bust. And then he goes to war with them, but before he goes to war, he takes a vow. And that's what we've been spending our time on the last couple of weeks, is this vow that Yiftach made. We talked about making such vows in general. And what we said was that there are really two different views of what it was that he vowed. Either the view of the Gemara, and reflected as well in Midrash, that he was pledging that whatever would come out of his house would be a karban, or the alternative view, which various commentators see in the Psukim, which is that it was a vow that whatever would come out of his house would be dedicated to Hashem. Those are the two basic possibilities, as we've discussed with some detail. Well, Yiftach wins the war, comes back home, and sure enough, it's his daughter who comes out of his house, and he says, "What am I supposed to do now? I've spoken, I can't take it back." And his daughter says, "No, you shouldn't take it back. You should go ahead and fulfill your vow." And what we then spent a little bit of time discussing, and what we have to continue with now, is what's this about? Why can't he back down? The Torah is very clear that there is a concept of hataras nedarim, of repealing vows. Why is it that he won't repeal it? By the way, the more I read about this, and the more I see what goes on with Yiftach, the more I realize, and I think I said a little bit last time as well, that Amon really does have an identity, and that identity comes through with Yiftach. Meaning, we've talked about each enemy the Jews have faced, and how the original character that we see with them in Chumash plays out for them through Tanakh, and plays out in the Jews, because they're being brought here to teach us a lesson. So we talked about it in the beginning of the Sefer with Aram, which was the group from which Abraham and Sarah had separated initially, and then we talked about it with Moab, and we brought it up with various nations along the way. We had it with Midian, and really the identity that I see for Amon, go back to where Amon came from, right? Amon is from Lot's daughter, who thinks that the world has ended and she needs to populate the world, and so she has a child with her father, with Lot, and that child is Amon. That's an idea. That image there is of somebody who thinks they're doing something good. They think they're doing something heroic, but what they're doing is terrible. What they're doing is the opposite of heroic. What they're doing is awful. And it's something that we see Lot do as well, right? Remember what happened when Lot was in stone? They offered his daughters, right? When they come to the house, when people in stone come to the house and say, you know, send us these guests of yours. So he says, "No, I'll give you my daughters instead." Lot believes he's doing something heroic. "Oh, I'm taking care of the strangers, the guests. I'm making sure that they'll be safe." Isn't that what Abraham would have done? And the answer is, of course not. You're out of your mind. That's not acceptable behavior. But he thinks he's doing something good. And that trait emerges with Yiftach, right? Here you have the person who thinks he's doing something good. He's taking a vow, and whatever comes out of my house, I'm going to dedicate to God, and I'm going to follow through with it, even if you find out that it's his daughter. And we're going to see it again with him, because this isn't his last story. We'll see it further along as well. Yiftach thinks that he's doing something wonderful, when in fact what he's doing is something terrible. So keep that in mind. It's actually reminiscent of the beginning and the whole theme of the Kuzari, right? For those who have learned Kuzari, I know we have some people who have learned Kuzari. This, the book begins with the story of the king of the Khazars, who has a dream in which he is told that his intentions are good, but the things he's doing are not good. And that's what ultimately leads him to try to find, so what is good? What am I supposed to be doing? And that's really the theme of the entire Sefer. It comes through in many different ways, that what Hashem wants from you is not simply good intentions, but that which he has actually told you you should do by revelation. That's revelation over logic. And that's what I think you see here is the weakness of Yiftach, that he thinks he knows what he's doing. He doesn't have any clue. So our first view of why he can't back down on this vow is simply ignorance about how vows work. Right? We saw that already in Ralbag, who said the Jews were so assimilated that Yiftach doesn't know about Ataras Nedar. Remember that they're 300 years into the land already. They have completely gone native, and he's not able to repeal it to get it. I'm sorry, he doesn't know that you can repeal it, and the judge doesn't have the option of repealing a vow without a request. That's Ralbag's position. Similarly, we have the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, which had said that Yiftach is not a person of Torah. Yiftach doesn't get it. He doesn't even realize that the vow shouldn't be binding and shouldn't even need repealing according to the Medrash. Because again, the Medrash is of the belief that this is a vow to bring his child as a korban. In which case, it's not binding in the first place. But he doesn't get that. Yeah.
Were there no religious people at this time? Anyone who could...
Not in his circle. Not in his circle. Right. Well, Pinchas is either not on the scene.
Like, you don't think that news travels?
So it definitely has to have traveled because we're told about the girls going to Wales and all that. But this is the state of the Jewish people at the time. I mean, we've said this. The Jews have continually regressed into Canaanite character. That's what this is fundamentally about. And I suspect that what you have are really two groups. You have those who don't know that there's such a thing as you can repeal his vow. And then you have those who believe that, no, this is a good thing. He should absolutely go ahead and fulfill his vow. This is the ideal. You know, we talked about this last time. You know, Mesha, the king of Moab, brings a child sacrifice. There are people there who actually think that this, you know, makes sense.
What about her mother, her wife? You never hear anything about her.
The Isha's, now, we don't even know if she's on the scene.
She didn't know me.
Well, not just not a name, but we're told that the relationship was not exactly, you know, a strong family structure. We don't know that.
We don't know. Remember, there was a compromise.
Radak, we took to the extreme at the end last time. Radak says, you know, not only is this vow not binding, but also Shimshon's mother's vow about him is also not binding. Right? Remember, we said that there's going to be a theme in this section of what parents do to their children. So this is, you know, this is very much a part of it. We had Gideon with his kid. We had, you know, having him do the execution, and we have Yiftach with his daughter here, and then we have Shimshon's mother with him. It's a theme, what parents do to their children. Yes, actually. Yes. Yes. We don't really want that, because your children are going to go, and they're going to say, I remember when my parents... No. Okay. So that's your first approach as to why this isn't being repealed. It's simply, Yiftach, his circle, aren't aware. They don't know. The second camp says repealing would be inappropriate. Not that it is inappropriate, but that's what Yiftach thinks. And Ramban says this. So source number one, this is Ramban on the Chumash, on a pasuk that talks about the binding character of a cherem, a decree, which cherem has different meanings in different places. It can be a dedication of property to the Kohanim or to the Beis HaMikdash. It can be a ban of excommunication. It has different meanings in different places. It's always, you know, a very significant decree. So look at what Ramban says. He says, "V'zehaya ta'uso shal Yiftach bevito." This was Yiftach's mistake with his daughter. "Ki chashav ka'asher cherem negid Yisrael chal v'kayam la'mis anashim o ha'over al chermo chayav misa." He says, just like if a Jewish leader issues a cherem, that can be binding. It can even involve capital punishment. It can involve capital punishment for someone who breaks the rules of the decree. Kain im nadar be'ez milchama, lasos me'ish o anashim zevach, yochol aneder. So too, It could happen that if the leader makes the vow, let's say the leader makes the vow in a time of war, saying that someone or someones will be made into a sacrifice, guess what? That works. I have the power to kill with my decree. So it happens to be that that's the case here. V'lo yada ki cherem ha-melech v'asanhedrin cholol ha-mordim l'chalosam. Oh, al ha-over gzeirasam v'takhanasam. What he didn't understand is that the potentially fatal repercussions of a cherem are specifically where the king of the Sanhedrin make a decree and somebody rebels against the decree. That's where there's such a thing. But not that you can decree to kill people. That's not a power that he has. To make a carbon out of somebody who's not eligible, which I didn't even translate, so I don't actually know how to translate those words. Chas would be like mercy. You know, Chalila is a desecration, but translating it as mercy and desecration doesn't really carry it. Yeah, well, that's what it's usually translated, but then the previous one was inappropriate for God, God forbid. It didn't read right, so I just left it as Chas Chalila. Okay, I think you know what it means. So that's Ramban's take, is that he actually thinks he can't back down because he's like a king. Rav Kook has a tshuva in which he just has more on this theme in Mishpat Kohen, Kuf Mem Dalet. Along the same lines, Mitzudat David, in number 2, says he thinks he can't back down, not because of the roles of a cherem of a king, but because, look, I made a deal with God. I said, if you do X, I'll do Y. God did X. So what am I supposed to do at this point? However, this guy Matanai, this is his daughter speaking, that she says to him, since the condition was fulfilled, Shamarta, you said, in Nason Titain, if you give the enemy into my hands and so on, in Kain Chalaneder, therefore the vow is now binding, and, you know, we just have to live with it. Malbim does something particularly interesting here, though. If you go back to the Pesukim, Malbim is very sharp. He's very sensitive to language, always. Go back into your Navi for a second to see what it is he's picking up on. In Pasuk Lamed He, right, sentence 35, what did Yiftach say? Right? He said at the end, he says, V'anochi patsisi fi al Hashem. Right? I blurted this out to God, and I can't back down. To which she says in 36 in Lamed Vav, Avi, my father, Patsisa Aspicha Hashem, you blurted this out to God, Aseli Kashayatami Picha, you should do what emerged from your mouth. After all, God did this to you. God did this on your behalf, I should say. So Mitzudat David is sensitive to the fact that his daughter says that Hashem did this for you. Right? That's what Mitzudat David picked up on. But Malbim picks up on the redundancy here. Right? Meaning in Pasuk Lamed Hey, in sentence 35, Yiftach already said, I can't back out. I blurted it, I can't back out. In 36 she says, you blurted it, you can't back out. What is she saying to him? He already said that. So Malbim says that's not the way to read it. It's also interesting that she uses the same phrase that he used. It's not a common phrase, but CCPS Hashem.
Could she just be agreeing with him? Or like, I accept?
Could be.
She said it in like, oh my God, this is what you did.
Well, Malbim says, actually, he was asking a question to which she was answering. He says in source number 3, Nira Perusho, Sheratza Lehischaret Vilish Ol Al Haneder. He says, I think what it means actually is that he wanted to express regret and to ask for the vow to be repealed. Kevin Sheishlo Pesach Harata, because he could say, you know, I regret it. I wish I had never made such a vow. And Shiva Lo, she replied, Shein Davar Zedom Lishar Nidarim Shayde Harata, the Meikara, Hacham Okir Aneda Meikara. She said, this isn't like other vows where you regret from the outset. You have a type of regret which goes back to the beginning of when you made the vow, not just I regret, I don't want to go through with it, but there's something fundamentally to be regretted about it, in which case the Chacham, the sage you go to, is able to uproot the vow. But you, you don't have regret going back to the beginning. Your regret is right now, I don't want to do this. Because after all, via this vow, you won. You beat the enemy. You can't regret the entire vow. It brought you victory over Ammon. The Jews were under Ammon. this is just the price you have to pay now, because your regret is not, you know, you're not going to say, I wish I had never taken this vow. You're going to say, I wish I had not given the stakes that I gave. Mm-hmm. That's not the same thing. Right. That's not, she said that's not acceptable. She happens to be wrong. It's not true. But that's what she says to her father. So her father says, and that's it, I'm stuck, I can't back out. Now, there are no punctuation marks. Mm-hmm. I can't back out. And she says, no, you blurted it, you can't back out. Because after all, look what God did for you, and therefore you're stuck with it.
So we don't know that God did that because he didn't know.
Correct. No, we don't at all. But, you know, that's the belief system they're operating with. That's why he took the vow in the first place.
But that's interesting because people were so non-observant, for lack of a better word. You know, they were not really praying to God, and they weren't observing the laws and whatever. You know, wouldn't you think that some daughter would be like, oh, how can you do that? How can we follow that? Like how all of a sudden now she's being so pious that you have to keep that vow when... they weren't really keeping anything else anyway. And don't you think just human nature, she would be like, isn't there some way you can get out of it?
Well, keep in mind where they're coming from. The choices for them are not Jewish or secular, Jewish or atheist. It's Jewish or the various idolatries of the area. Baal, Asherah, we've seen before in this book. So it's not that they've become people who don't believe in God. They just... you know, are very believing. They believe in gods, and they're likely superstitious. And so it could well be, especially knowing that Moab has this idea also of child sacrifice, it could be just the opposite. This is like, okay, yeah, this is what we do. This is what the neighbors would do. You know? It's not, she's not a non-pious person. She's just differently pious, is what I would say. That's the way to, I think that would be the way to frame it. Now, those are the two main views. Either it's ignorance, that they don't know there is such a thing and that this is an option, or they think it's inappropriate. There are three other views that are expressed which are worth knowing. First of all, Abarbanel says, simply, his daughter told him, don't repeal it. He doesn't say anything about why there's no repealing, but his daughter said, don't repeal it, and that's that. No sort of conversation in Abarbanel as to why, simply part of what he says. But then you get two more views that are very interesting. The interesting meaning troubling. The fourth view is that it was stubbornness. It was a matter of stubbornness. Take a look at source number 4. We've quoted parts of this Medrash before. Medrash Bereishis Rabba. V'lo haya sham Pinchas sheyatio lo es nidro. Wasn't Pinchas around? Ela Pinchas Amar Hutzarech Liva Ani Elech Lo. Pinchas said, "Why he needs me? Why should I go to him?" V'yiftach. Look, you know, when you get to that age, V'yiftach Amar Ani Rosh Kitzinei Yisrael V'ani Holech Liyetal Pinchas. To which Yiftach says, "Me, I am the head of all the officers of Israel, right? Newly crowned. I'm going to go to Pinchas. Bein Dain L'Dain, between this and this one and that one, of the Hanara Hahi, the girl was lost." Now, you'll say to me, can that be? You can just do that and get away with it. The answer is no. Ushneim nenshu b'damashal nara. And both of them were punished for the blood of the girl, because remember that this Medrash believes that she's actually killed. So both of them are punished for her death. Yiftach meis b'nishilas evarim. B'chol makom shayholech bo haya evar nishol heimenu v'yukovrin ososham. Yiftach dies with the loss of limbs, meaning that he has some kind of a flesh rotting disease, and wherever he goes, he loses limbs. Where in the world did you get that idea from? How dichsiv? Because we're going to see at the end of his story, Vayamas Yiftach, Vayikaver Ba'arei Gilad. Yiftach died, and he was buried in the cities of Gilad. So, cities, plural. Be'ir Gilad Onamar, Ela Ba'arei Gilad. That's pretty gross. Pinchas Nitlami Menuruach HaKodesh. There's a reason they like to teach the boys Shoftim. Pinchas Nitlami Menuruach HaKodesh. And as far as Pinchas, he lost access to Hashem. Ha'u Dirsiv, because the famous pasuk we've quoted a couple of times, which said that Pinchas makes it to the time of David HaMelech, right? The pasuk can be read in multiple ways. Is it really saying Pinchas is there, or is it saying, there's a pasuk in David's time that says Pinchas had been the leader who spoke in the name of God. So the question is, does it mean literally Pinchas is now the leader? Or does it mean, no, Pinchas had been the leader at one point in the past, but not that in David's time he is. But either way, it doesn't matter for our purposes. The point is that the wording is, as you see here, Pinchas ben Elazar, Nagid haya aleihem. He had been the Nagid, the leader. So, who Nagid aleihem ein ksiv kan? It doesn't say he is the leader. Ela Nagid haya, he was the leader, and the pasuk continues, Lefanim Hashem imo. Back in the day, when Hashem had been with him. Back in the day, Hashem had been with him. In other words, Pinchas is punished by losing access to God. Now,
how does that as Yitzchak? Like, Yitzchak right. Way worse.
Well, that was his vow. You know, and in the circumstances, he is the one who should have gone to Pinchas. If you ask me, you know, who should have gone to whom, you know, Yitzchak should have been the first one out the door. Well, that's a bad phrase. You know what I mean.
Yes.
But in terms of the storyline, and you know, this is not measure for measure. You know, this is not mita keneged mita. It's not like, you know, Yiftach did this and now therefore this happened. It's a pasuk. I have a verse. It lends itself to this reading, and therefore I'm going to read it that way. As we'll see when we get to that pasuk, there are other ways, simpler ways to read that sentence. You don't have to read it as Pinchas had Yiftach had multiple graves. So that's another explanation, that's four. And then there's a fifth, which puts the onus on God. Take a look at source number five, Medrash Tanchuma. It's part of a longer Medrash, which is on a pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk says, Gever Rosh Ve'osheg Dalim, and there's more to the pasuk that we'll see in a moment, but Gever Rosh Ve'osheg Dalim. A Rosh, Resh Shin, is somebody who is impoverished. So somebody who is poor, Ve'osheg Dalim, and he turns around and oppresses the weak. Ze Yiftach, says the Medrash. That's talking about Yiftach. For what he did, whether it's talking about what he did to his daughter, but talking about what he did to Ephraim, which is a story we haven't seen yet, or whether it's maybe even what he did with his Anashim Rekim, I don't know. And there's a piece there that I skipped here. Lafichach, as a result of such a person, Matar Socheif Ve'ein Lachem. There will be a forceful rain, but there will be no bread. Meaning, Shahayalo Mishayatiras Nidro. He had somebody who could have repealed the vow. Matar Sochek, the rain is there. Ve'ein Lachem, there's no bread. Shehelim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mehem Es HaHalacha. Hashem caused them to forget the law. He had someone, it should have been able to happen, and God caused Pinchas to forget that he could do this. Shalom Yimtzu Pischo La'atirlo Es Nidro. In order to prevent him from having the vow repealed. In other words, the vow could have been repealed. However, actually the Medrash says it's for the punishment for what he's going to do with the people of Ephraim in the next parak. Therefore, there's a punishment that he's going to lose his daughter. Now you'll say, well, wait a minute, what did she do? Right? Why did she deserve this? To which the answer is, we see this repeatedly in the Torah, the idea that a family is a unit, and that people will suffer for the sins of family members. The most famous, of course, example is when Hashem says he'll punish the next generation, the third generation, fourth generation. And yes, the Gemara asks, well, how can that be? After all, they didn't sin. The person who suffers for his own crimes, and the Gemara answers, it's where they continue the crimes of the parents. Having said all of that, we have a basic principle that, yes, a family is considered a unit. And you gain merit that way. So we have a concept of chus avos, right? Your ancestors do something good and you get merit for it. But on the other hand, it also means the ancestors can sin and the children will suffer for it. Which happens in society also, right? People go to jail and their children may suffer for it. And that's you know, the way it works. So that's...
I mean, we can give a lot of explanations, but ultimately we're not going to know. To what degree is divine orchestration involved in that side of it, as opposed to just the side of not repealing it?
Was Yiftach aware of Pinchas? Like,
yes.
Did he know that Pinchas?
He even had a Navi before, which we said maybe Pinchas. Okay. But maybe the answer, Ora, is that actually the two stories don't read that way. In other words, when we get to Perek Yud Bet, we're going to see that story is right after the military victory. Because what's going to happen is going to begin with Ephraim saying, why didn't you call me for the victory? So it's entirely possible that that's before the conclusion of, we can't repeal this. We just finished the story about the vow and all that. But in fact, chapter 12 happens first. And I think that actually works. It makes sense that it would be. Okay. By the way, for those who weren't sure, the recording is now on. So just know that from this point on, you have to be more careful. Okay. So this is the story. The vow is not repealed. Just as we're going to see with Shimshon, he is a, you know, his mother can do this to him. So too, Yiftach is able to do this to his daughter. It's not gender specific. Parents can harm their sons. Parents can harm their daughters. Mothers, well, it doesn't make a difference. Okay. So that brings us to the closing few sentences in this perek, starting with Pasuk Lamed Zayin, sentence 37. Vatomer el aviha. She said to her father, Ye asa li hadavar hazeh. This, whatever you vowed, should be done to me. Harpe mi meni shnayim chadashim. Let me go for 2 months. Ve'elchav yaradati al heharim. And I am going to go and ve'yaradati al heharim. An odd phrase. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I am going to descend on the mountains. So Rashi, Radak, say that's not what it means. A raid is used sometimes in Tanakh to refer to crying, not to descending. So it could be that that's what it means. It means to cry. Actually, I wonder if someone does this. I didn't look it up. But, you know, when Yaakov finds out that Yosef is gone and he thinks he's dead, he says, Ki ered el bini avel sha'ola. And we usually say, I will descend because of my son to Sheol, which makes sense because Sheol is supposed to be down. Sheol is the grave, whatever it is. So ered, I'll descend. But I wonder if it isn't, I will cry to the grave. I wonder. I have to look that up and see whether anybody makes that connection there.
My translation is wailing.
Yeah. Right, that's consistent with this. There are a couple of other explanations, though. Radak's answer is that the mitzpeh was where he lived. Mitzpeh is an overlook. So it could be there are mountains, but then this is an outcropping that's higher, and she's saying, I'm going to go down from the mitzpeh down among the mountains. That's another offer from Radak. And then the Medrash Tanchuma, the same Medrash Tanchuma in number 5, that said that those who should have repealed forgot that they could. Hashem made them forget. So Rashi quotes that to say mountains can mean the Sanhedrin. And what she's saying is, I'm going to descend before them to argue for repealing the vow. Okay. A lot of different explanations, because fundamentally we have a pasuk with a problem. Descending to mountains is not what I would have expected, and therefore we need to explain.
So why can't she just cry with the girls at home?
No. Right. So one of the things we need to understand is what's this 2 month trip to the mountains? Why the retreat? What exactly is this about? No. Well, it's where it may be. One of the views is going to be it's where her cottage will be.
But then she comes back.
Well, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Yeah, if she didn't get killed, then she would probably just go and stay. Why come back?
There.
So that's what we're going to have to deal with. Pasuk Lamed Ches. Vayomer Lechi. He says, go. Vayishlach Osa Shnei Chodashim. He sends her off. She goes for 2 months. Vatelechi Verei Osa. She went with her friends. Vatevka Besuleha Al Heharim. And she cries for her bitulim. She cries for the fact that she's never going to have children. That's the crying that she does there. Vahimi Kate Shnayim Chadashim, after 2 months, Vatasha Vel Havia, she goes back to her father, Vayaz Loes Nidro Asher Nadar, and he did as he had vowed, Vihilo Yada Ish, she had not been with a man, Vatichok V'Yisrael, and now here, the Pasuk break should be ignored. You, according to most readings, the pasuk break should be ignored. Vatihi chok bi Yisrael, it was the law in Israel, miyamim yamima, every year, telachna benos Yisrael lesanos levas Yiftach agiladi, that the daughters of Israel would go to wail for the daughter of Yiftach, arbat yamim bashana, 4 days a year, which I believe means a 1 4-day trip each year. Not that there were 4 days on the calendar when they would go cry, you know, like one per season or something. But that it was a single 4-day mission, which I'll tell you right now, I will not have any explanation for why 4 days. I have no idea. Just what?
Right.
So 2 months, I have an explanation for. Okay. But
and it looks like she's crying to the mountains almost. Like, what is that phrase, Al Hamarim?
Well, that's upon the mountains. You know, I'm in the mountains and I'm crying.
She's crying upon the mountains about.
Yeah, off in the mountains, she's you know, crying. So first of all, just on a very basic level, what happened with this? What was this practice? So Rashi offers you the two ways to read Vatichok b'Yisrael. Either it became the law in Israel, period, in which case what it means in terms of the law was the law not to make vows like this. This created, you know, like you have laws in memory of somebody when somebody gets hurt in some tragic situation, so they make a law to prevent that from happening in the future. So this is Yiftach daughter's law. Don't make dumb vows. The other way that you can read it, though, is that it's the beginning of the next sentence. The practice was that they would go off into the woods and do this. The Radak says that the point of this is to visit her and to cry with her, because Radak is of the view that she's not executed. She's living off in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. So the practice was that every year people would go to cry with her. I brought it for you in the sheet in number 6.
So and why would she have to be living somewhere else for people to cry for her and feel bad for her?
Well, I think it's the other way around. People are crying for her because she's off living somewhere else.
Yeah, okay.
The question is, why is she living somewhere else?
Right. Like, why can't she just be
alone at home?
Because there was a vow.
But what did the vow say? That's the thing. You know, let me just read Radak first and then come back to this question, because we have to understand this. Vayachog b'Yisrael, the law was in Israel, ki mishana l'shana hayu elchos eleha benos Yisrael l'sanos la. Now the daughters of Israel would actually go annually to wail to her, klomar l'konein v'livkos abasu leha ima. That they're going to cry with her, they're visiting her. Now, chok, by the way, does not have to mean law in the sense of, like, don't wear shatnez. Chok can simply mean this was the embedded practice. That's really what it's getting at here. But in terms of the greater picture of what's going on, you could actually read in these last few sentences support for either interpretation of what the vow was. Whether the vow was to bring as a sacrifice, or the vow was to dedicate to God. Can you prove from me that it's not to bring as a sacrifice? It's only that she'll have to go off on her own. She'll have to be dedicated to God.
Meant to cry with her, goes with her, so she meant to be alive.
Right, crying with her sounds like she's alive. What else?
Right, not like a grave.
The repeated emphasis of how she's not going to have children. Mm-hmm. They're crying because she never had children, she won't have children. Even going back to the beginning of the Perek, she's the only one, right? Mm-hmm. This whole business with her being unable to have children, which is true no matter which way you read the vow. But if you take the vow as dedicated to God and therefore unable to have a family, then this fits much better. The emphasis is she's now stuck. She won't have the rest of her life. She'll just be dedicated to God. However, the flip side of it is, why is she wandering for 2 months? If it's just a matter of not being able to have a family or whatever it is, she could live at home.
And they have to make sure she wasn't pregnant.
Well, that's interesting. I actually did read a source.
To wait it out. Right.
No, I read something about, and I left it in the end. I read something more complicated about the 2 months, and it had something to do with that, but I'm not remembering exactly what the position was. I did see something like that. But the idea of wandering for 2 months tends to suggest she was going to get killed, and she just wants some time before it's going to be carried out, you know, to live life, to see things. However, Abarbanel says that's not necessarily proof of anything. Take a look at Abarbanel number 7, because this is going to go back to something that somebody said before in the previous week. I don't, it was either Ora or Roberta. I don't remember. Take a look at what Abarbanel does. Biksha mimenu she'anicha le'red al ha'harim shnayim chadashim livkos al besula im reyosa. She asks of him, she'd like 2 months to go off in the mountains and so on to cry. V'haya zel lefi shahaysa asida leos prusha v'bayis echad lo seitzei misham kol yimechayah. He says the answer is because she can't stay in her house, because being dedicated to God actually means going off in isolation. She is going to be alone in the wilderness for the rest of her life. Viksha shetelech shnayim chadashim ba'asher tirtze. So, and not just alone in the wilderness, but alone in a house. She can't go out. I guess they have to bring her food and like slip it under the door. But she requests, she wants 2 months to go wherever she wants to go. V'tasbia rucha mehanedud v'ahalicha. She wants to satisfy herself from wandering. In other words, let me have some good memories of what it's like to have freedom of movement. Ya lo tanud v'lo telech od kol yameh, because she's never going to be able to do that again. V'zeo v'evke al besulai shlo tinasei od, and that's why she has to cry that she won't get married. She's going to be stuck alone in this house. V'gam telech livchor makom yishivasa b'prishus, and also, this way, she can pick the place where she's going to live. That's where her cottage is going to be. The Kavanah C, and he says, you know what I think? Shemizelam du umat edom, lazos bate precious, cloister. Lenashim sheyechnesu sham, avalo yetu misham kol yimehem, velo yiru ish baod b'chayim cheyosam. And I think that's where Edom is Rome. I think that's where Rome learned to have this practice of what is essentially a nunnery. There's a place where they go off to be alone, and they never leave it for their entire lives, and they never were the man. So he says, I think they got it from Yiftach's daughter.
Yeah, that's what Alina was saying.
You said it. Okay.
Like,
that she's gonna become a nun. Mitzvah David brings it, but he's later than a barba now. Whether this is actually where nuns come from, I don't think is. He's the end of the 15th century. Yeah. Yeah, he's very familiar with the church. They kicked him out of his country twice. Yeah,
I'm wondering, contrast that with like the young men who were separated for Hashem and they went to work in the Beit HaMikdash and do actual avoda. In what way is she serving Hashem by being in a house alone?
Right. So we read a line earlier, one of the Mefarshim last week, who suggested that her life is going to be one of just prayer. She's going to dive into Hashem. That's what she's going to spend her life doing, is contemplating and praying to God. That's how she is separated for God. That's the way they read it. Keep in mind, his original wording of his vow, right? Go back to, where was it? Yeah, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, V'haya L'Hashem. It will be for God. I'm going to bring it up as a burnt offering, which is what makes us think it's a carbon. But being dedicated to God means that's the focus of their existence. They have to sit there in this house, bless you. Hopefully it has more than one room. They just contemplate God. Maybe they tend to something, they weave something, I don't know. We're not given any information whatsoever. We don't even know if this happened. For all we know, she was simply executed.
Mm-hmm. But other people were dedicated to God and they did it so well.
Yeah.
Well, that was
dedicated to God. And
correct. And that was the point that we raised last week with Ralbag, right? I think it was Ralbag. It was Ralbag who said, my proof that the view that she has to be alone... No, sorry. Some said that the proof that she has to be alone some said that you could prove that she had to be a karban because Shmuel is dedicated to God and yet he doesn't have to be alone, to which Rabag replied, that's because he's a man. And if she's a woman, then she'd have to be serving her husband as well. That was Rabag's approach. I don't expect you to like it, but it's Torah, I have to say it. But those are the different views. So this is Yiftach and his daughter. It is dysfunctional. It is not meant as a role model, like this is what you should do. This is an example of how far we have fallen. And Yiftach is exhibit A. His daughter, is either a casualty or she's just as brainwashed as he is. But this is an, this is, as I said, what Amon is like. People who think they're doing something good and what they're doing is terrible. But as I said in my email, it doesn't get better, it gets worse. Take a look at Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12. Yiftach has seven psukim to go. Vayitzo'ik ish Ephraim. The people of Ephraim were called into battle. Vayitzo'ik is a term that's used for rallying people. So Ephraim, right? Yiftach, remember, was from Menashe. He's off to the east. Ephraim is not off to the east. But Ephraim rallies. Vayavor Tzafona, and they go north. Yes, they are. Right, remember this story with them. This is not new. Vayamru li Yiftach, and they said to Yiftach, Madua avartu li lachem bivnei Amon, v'lanu lo karas ala chesimach, why'd you go fight with Amon, and you didn't call us? Beischa nisrov alecha bo'esh. We're going to burn your house down. Yeah, I mean, this is not... Right. Now, before you get too far into the story, go back to Perichet, chapter 8, sentence 1. If you remember the story after Gideon fought his successful war against Midian, or started the successful war against Midian, the war is still going on. Vayomru Elav, Ish Ephraim. Ephraim says to Gideon, Ma davar hazeh asisa lanu, what have you done to us? Livel tikros lanu, not calling us. Ki alachta li lachim b'Midian, you went to fight Midian. Vayrivuno ito b'chazka, and they fought him powerfully. Now there, the way the story ends, is he says, you guys are great. We haven't done half of what you do, right? You're helping to pursue this war now, and you're going to destroy them. And what do I do? That's like you. You get Oravens, Abe, the heads of their armies. I'm nothing compared to you. That was the approach that Gideon took. Well, Yiftach, not so much. He may have been diplomatic with Amon before, but take a look at Pasuk Bet. Vayomer Yiftach Alehem. Hey, Perek Yud Bet, Pasuk Bet, chapter 12, sentence 2. Yiftach said to them, Ish Riv Hayisi Ani Ve'ami Uvnei Amon Ma'od. He says, I have been fighting with Amon, suffering under Amon, me and my nation, for a very long time. Vazak Eschem. And you know what? I cried out to you. V'la Hoshatem Osi Miyadam. You didn't save me. Meaning, where have you been? Right? That's what he says. You're coming to me now. I saw you were doing nothing. And I took my life in hand. And I crossed over to Amon. The crossing, presumably, is to denote going from the west of the Yarden over to the east. We've seen that phrase twice here. God gave them into my hand. Why are you now starting trouble with me? So Yiftach gathers all the people of Gilad, and he goes to war with Ephraim. The people of Gilad strike Ephraim. Ki amru plitei Ephraim atem Gilad besoch Ephraim besoch Menashe. That clause I'm not going to translate yet because there are two very different ways to read it, and it affects the story. So right now I'm not translating it, except to say somebody said something to somebody. Vayakod Gilad is Mabaros Hayarden le'Ephraim. Gilad conquered the crossings of the Yarden for Ephraim, meaning took them from Menashe. I'm sorry, the other way around. From Ephraim, yeah, he took them from Ephraim for Menashe. Vayah ki yomru plitei Ephraim e'evora. And when the people from Ephraim wanted to run away, and they said, I want to cross, we're running away from you. Vayomru, no, not running away from you, sorry. They just said, we're innocent people who want to cross. Vayomru lo anshe Gilad. The people of Gilad said to them, Ha'efrati ata, are you from Ephraim? Vayomru lo. They said, no, absolutely not. Ephraim, who me? I'm from Naphtali. Vayomru lo, and they said to him, to whoever was crossing, Emorna shibolet. Say the word shibolet. Why shibolet will come back to. You've heard this before, right? You know what a shibboleth is in English. It's from this story. They said, say shibolet. Vayomer sibolet. They couldn't say the shin. Velo yachin ledaber kain. They couldn't speak that way. They couldn't pronounce the letter. Why? We'll talk about. Veyochazu oso. And then they would grab him. Vayishchatu amabaros hayardain. And they would slaughter him at the crossing of the Yarden. And in this war, Ephraim lost 42,000 people. And Yiftach went on to rule for 6 more years, or 6 years total. He died, and as we've seen, he's buried in the cities of Gilad. Okay.
It could just be that it's a cluster of areas that's
right. Yeah. No, absolutely true. But that's much less fun. I mean, really? Do you really want to read it that way? Okay. So what questions do we have about these psukim?
I just wonder, why did he initiate this? Like, it's not like the Ephraim would have come to them, he initiated the war.
Well, he was told to do it.
What just happened?
The people came and said, we need a general.
That's how they translated it.
The people of Gilad said, we need a leader, and they came to him and said, will you lead us in battle?
No, but I'm saying when Ephraim complained now,
yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, Yiftach is... killing them.
Yeah.
Like,
so they say, why did you call us? And he goes and attacks them all?
Yes. He's attacking them for just when they ask the question. Like,
right. So that's one thing. Isn't this a little bit of an overreaction?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. What else is weird here?
What's with the pronunciation of the
word? What is Nebel?
Yeah, what's with that? And why did you choose the word Shibboleth?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it is now in English. Shibboleth is sort of the password mm-hmm. that you say in order to demonstrate that you are from the right side. Mm-hmm. The
so who made it up?
Yeah. No. Well, it comes from this.
It comes from
this. But
in the world or in Judaism?
No, in the world.
Really?
Yes, there was. Yes. No. There was a TV show episode. After I turn off the audio later, I'll tell you. There was a TV show episode where they used it.
Shibboleth mean like a wheat bundle.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the question is, why'd you pick that? It's a bundle of weed, Shibboleth. Mm-hmm. Usually, you'll read it with Rus. Mm-hmm. So that's something we need to figure out here. And that's part of what we have to figure out here is this business of the brothers. And what's this business in Pasuk Dalet? In sentence 4, which I didn't translate, right? Ki amru pliteya Ephraim atem Gilad besoch Ephraim besoch Menashe. Right? What does the art scroll say there in the end of sentence 4? How do they read that? They said what?
For even the rabble of Ephraim had said, of what worth are you, Gilad, you who dwell in the midst of Ephraim, in the midst of Menashe?
So, according to that read, according to that read, it was an insult that Ephraim had done to Menashe, that Menashe now is looking to pay back. That's one way to read it. We'll see there are more. So, my warning to you in this section in general is that there are only villains in this story. There are only villains of varying degrees in this story. There are no heroes, no matter how you read the story. Yiftach, at best, will be considered to be defending himself from bad people who have threatened him. Right? We're going to burn your house down. At worst, which we'll see in a medrash, he's an arrogant brute who ends up paying for this with his daughter's life, as we've already discussed somewhat. So that's Yiftach. The people of Ephraim, at best, are offended people who overreact. And that's Abarbanel's view, Malbim's view. And at worst, per Ralbag, they're jealous and ungrateful and insulting barbarians. So, there are no good people in this story. There's no one to root for.
You said this happened before in the story previously, though.
It's before the end of the story previously. In other words, it's after he came out of the house, because he's home. Mm-hmm. After she came out of the house, right?
It could be during the two
during the 2 months, because it's right after the war when they're complaining. Yeah. So that's the way I read, and that would explain how the Medrash could say that the punishment for him,
he finished the story.
That's right. That's the way that I would. That's the way that I would read it. So, the first question you have to ask is, what's with Ephraim, right? Why is Ephraim doing this to Yiftach? So Abarbanel says it's personal. You'll see. It's personal, but take a look. Source number 9. He says, Lefisha Gilad Hayalachatzi Shevet HaMenashe. The land in Gilad, belongs to half of Menashe, the half that's on the other side of the Yarden. Umilevad heyos Ephraim uMenashe achim, aside from the fact that they're brothers, shaya ra'ui sheyazru ishalachiv, so that it would have been appropriate for them to come help, right? I mean, they're all brothers, but, you know, Ephraim and Menashe, closer. Hine od haya gevul Ephraim samuch aleihem, but Ephraim is also next to Menashe. So it made sense that they should have helped, and now they feel like they look back, they didn't help. It would have made sense for Gilad to call them. And people, I think, would assume that they called them and they just didn't come. But Abarbanel says, if you notice the way it's worded, it's specifically they attack Yiftach personally. Is why? Because they thought it wasn't the fault of the people of Gilad. It was Yiftach's arrogance. And so they complained specifically to Yiftach. They love Amru, and it was to him that they said, we're going to burn your house in fire. That's Abarbanel's read. Malbim says, it's more than that. More personal than that. It goes back to the beginning of Ephraim and Menashe. When did we first see Ephraim and Menashe in the Chumash? When they got the bracha, right?
Ephraim got the better
bracha. And Ephraim was put ahead of Menashe. So take a look. Source number 10. Malbim says, V'ratzulis rofeso, they wanted to burn his house down. Kilo eskimu on the siuso, they didn't believe he should be the leader. Kamoshi yivayar apasuk dalid, which we'll get to. V'ayalem hata'anash, are you gedolim in Menashe beis Yosef? They said, hey, Ephraim goes ahead of Menashe. Vayasim es Ephraim lefnei Menashe. Vayedekach ha'elilu alav. So they said, who is he that he should be leading? But I think this is also part of the general theme of Amon and Yiftach. People who think they're doing something good, right? And they just do it in this very warped way. They think, we want to show, we want to fight. We're warriors. And so we're going to complain at to Yiftach and we're going to punish him for not calling us.
Just be grateful, you know, that he defeated the enemy for them.
Yeah.
Like, why do they want to go to war, really?
Right.
It's
right.
Because they lost the honor to defeat the enemy.
Right.
But it's also, it was the opposite for him, because didn't he not want this war in the first place with them? Or didn't he call and say, like, why are you doing this?
Well, unless that was just, you know, what you do diplomatically. And, you know, he was actually hoping that they'd say no, which we also find happen, you know.
But he was so diplomatic to Amon, but not to Ephraim.
But that's what I'm saying. So the question is, so why does he respond this way? So we have to get there. One interesting problem here within this is that if you look back at the pasuk, we didn't note this when we read it, but how did they go? Where did they go to get to him?
To who? I'm losing.
In pasuk Aleph, in sentence 1, where did Ephraim go to get to Yiftach? To the north. Ephraim doesn't go north to get to Menashe, they go east. Mm-hmm. Rashi says they went north, so maybe somewhere within the region it's somehow north. That Mikra says no, there must be a city called Safon, right? On the way to Mitzvah. He also adds, they don't actually talk to Yiftach face to face, right? Because, and this makes sense, you know, Yiftach is going to rally troops, so obviously they're not having a face-to-face conversation. So he says what happened was they're going towards Yiftach, and then they meet Yiftach's men along the way, and they convey this this complaint.
There is a Menashe to the north of Ephraim.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's Menashe.
Because they extend all the way up to the Bashan.
Both sides of the Yarden.
Yeah.
Right? So Menashe is on both sides of the Yarden. So if they were in Ephraim, they could have gone north.
But they're going across the Yarden to Gilad, right?
But they said they went to Safona.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. And maybe that doesn't mean north. Maybe that means they went to the city to foam. That's the dot mikra approach, and I think there's something to be said for it. But Rashi does say to the north, so yeah, it could be. Sorry?
This one says it's a place in the Jordan Valley near Sukkot.
Okay, so they're, who are they quoting? Usually they give you who they're referencing.
Joshua?
Oh, they're just saying there is a city. We found a city called Safon. Okay. Okay, good. So what we'll have to pick up with next time, I guess, is Yiftach's answer to them. Why in the world does he reply so harshly? And what exactly is the meaning of what he said? How are we supposed to read that? So we'll pick up with that. We'll talk about the Shibboleth issue. All of that next week, God willing.